with 115 justices. You're the first Black woman, and it's long past time.
So the hearings are going to be challenging, informative for the public, and respectful by us. It won't be a circus.
That featured Spartacus moments, featured such nuts as Michael Avenatti.
The first justice since Thurgood Marshall, with significant experience representing low-income defendants and criminal cases.
Maybe some who claim that you'll be a rubber stamp for this president. For these would-be critics, I have four words. Look at the record.
Senators Dick Durbin, Dianne Feinstein, Ted Cruz, Lindsey Graham, and Amy Klobuchar during the first half of today's confirmation hearing for Supreme Court nominee Ketanji Brown Jackson. President Biden's nominee is the first Black woman nominated to the high court. Republicans say she's soft on crime and funded by left-wing dark money groups. Democrats hit back saying, look at her record. So we're going to look at her record with Press Play's Legal Eagle, Jessica Levinson. She teaches at Loyola Law School and joins us every Monday with her insights and her analysis. Hello.
Hello. Happy first day of the Senate confirmation hearings. What a day.
This must be a very exciting moment for you. So let us first address some of these allegations from the Republicans and a lot of these soft on crime allegations. And that's because she was a federal public defender for a while. Missouri Republican Senator Josh Hawley has really for days been pulling on one particular thread. And today he spent his entire opening statement laying out several cases in which he accused her of being soft when it comes to sentencing people accused and convicted of sex crimes, especially involving child pornography. And here's what he said.
I think it's difficult against this backdrop to argue that the sentencing guidelines are too harsh or outmoded, or that we should be somehow treating child porn offenders more leniently than the guidelines recommend.
All right, so what is he talking about? What's her record on these types of cases?
I think what he's talking about, honestly, is trying out a presidential stump speech, because her record doesn't indicate that there's any there when it comes to these allegations. You don't have to take my word for it. Think about conservative-leaning outlets like the National Review that have talked about Senator Hawley's accusations here and said they're disingenuous at best. So really what he's looking at is either cases that she heard while she was a district court judge, where she sentenced defendants. And there's nothing to indicate that she was outside of the norm, including outside the norm of progressive and conservative jurists when she sentenced this. I think what we're seeing, frankly, the fact that he went ahead with this line of attack showed me that there's a schism among Republicans in the Senate in terms of what exactly they're going to attack her on. You saw the other Republicans in the Senate really just focusing on this kind of general soft on crime. He was the only one I heard go through this. And then he has this kind of at the end, after he's basically accused her of, you know, being soft at best on people engaged in or possession of child pornography, he has this, well, at least it's a question worth asking. And so what I hear really is him, honestly, a bit on an island.
Well, she sentenced the Pizzagate shooter, right, to 4 years in prison, and he pleaded guilty, that guy.
Exactly, right.
Right. Is that what Hawley's referring to obliquely? Is that which is wrapped up in QAnon and all that kind of stuff?
So the reason I'm pausing is because I don't think there's a lot to take on case by case. So yes, he could be alluding to that. Absolutely. But this idea, it seems to me that he zeroed in on the worst possible thing that we could charge any person with, particularly in the law, which is really just being too soft on people who are abusing children and abusing children in a sexual way. And he's decided that this is going to be his path forward. So yes, I think in part he's talking about Pizzagate, in part he's talking about less high profile cases. But I didn't see any of his colleagues pick up on that, which I thought was really interesting.
Okay, so another thread that the Republicans are pulling is this idea that she's funded by left-wing dark money groups. And here is Texas Republican Senator John Cornyn.
Dark money groups like Demand Justice have paid millions of dollars to promote court packing and sow public distrust in the legitimacy of the Supreme Court.
All right. So what is he or other Republicans accusing Judge Jackson of when it comes to this group and others?
Basically, they're saying you're the beneficiary of and therefore supported by and therefore beholden to left-wing groups, these so-called dark money groups, like you heard them call out by name, Demand Justice, a progressive group that started, I believe, 4 years ago. And the idea is to push Democrats to the left when it comes to a lot of judicial issues. Something that you heard Democrats respond, I think maybe not strongly enough, is the idea that this is happening on both sides, not just with respect to judicial nominees, but with respect to political nominees and political candidates, where they are the beneficiaries of these nonprofit spending, in many cases, quote unquote, dark money, because we don't know the ultimate source behind all of their funding. And this is something that can cut both ways. On the one hand, it can allow politicians or judges some level of support. It can allow them to get their names out there. On the other hand, it's hard for them, if they want to disassociate from these groups, because they are, by definition, many times independent. So I think you're seeing that tension a little bit. Interesting that Republicans are taking this tact because, of course, we have many powerful nonprofit groups that are conservative groups also spending money. Let's think back to the three recent nominees to the Supreme Court by President Trump who are now on the court.
Right. And we heard Senator Sheldon Whitehouse from Rhode Island bring that up when it came to, for instance, Brett Kavanaugh's nomination. And speaking of, how much of these past nominations became a current fodder in today's statements?
I think that Justice Kavanaugh was almost mentioned more than Judge Jackson. It was stunning to me how the ghost of the Kavanaugh hearings was evoked so many times, where you saw Senate Republicans say in so many ways, well, we're going to be better. We're going to be nice to you. We're not going to dig into your personal life and accuse you of horrible things. This isn't going to be a circus. Nobody's going to spit on you. This is going to be different in every way. But of course, in talking more and more about that, they're in a way reminding us of the accusations against Justice Kavanaugh, which I don't think is particularly helpful for their argument. But they're also reminding us of, in a way, how not useful, what a circus these confirmations have become, even if it's not what happened with respect to the Kavanaugh hearing. So I have to say, maybe it's naive, but I'm surprised by how this is one of the themes that they have decided to latch onto, this idea of, can you believe what happened to Justice Kavanaugh?
Hmm. So you have John Cornyn and Lindsey Graham both voted for her on the when she was up for the D.C. Court of Appeals. Now they're saying, or they're indicating, that they might not vote for her. Is that just pure politics?
Well, they're saying, you know, it's different when it comes to confirming somebody to the D.C. Court of Appeals. It's a different standard than for the Supreme Court. Nothing in her record has changed other than that she has some very thoughtful rulings regarding the scope of executive privilege that you and I have talked about on past segments. So I think it's politics. But look, this is a political process by definition. You have somebody picked by the president who's going to be confirmed by the Senate. So, of course, politics is involved, but not a great day for the American public in terms of seeing their senators talk about the Constitution and Supreme Court nominees.
Jessica Levinson teaches at Loyola Law School. She's our regular legal eagle here on Press Play. Jessica, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're going to talk about how hard it is for Africans to flee Ukraine. They're being denied seats on trains. And when they get to the Polish border, for example, some aren't allowed in. We're going to talk about that next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Nearly 3.5 million Ukrainians have fled the country since Russia invaded less than a month ago. Russian attacks on civilian spaces have made escaping Ukraine extremely difficult. For people who are not Ukrainian and who are not white, it is nearly impossible. Africans living in Ukraine report walking for hours to buses and trains headed out of the country only to be barred from leaving. That's been confirmed by several media outlets like The Washington Post and CBS News. And here's a student from Ghana. Her name is Ethel Otto.
Mostly they would consider white people first, Indian people, Arabic people, before black people.
Well, to talk about this, we're joined now by historian Kimberly St. Julian Varnon. She's a PhD fellow at the University of Pennsylvania and an expert in race and foreign policy in Russia and Ukraine. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's my pleasure. You worked with some students, I understand, to help them get out of Ukraine, some African students. What were their experiences?
Yes, I was working directly with African students and Indian students who were in Sumy, Ukraine, so northern Ukraine near the border with Russia, and they had actually been under siege for 2 weeks. And so I was helping them secure food, but also helping them stay calm because a lot of them were worried that, you know, there were rumors that foreign students were being used as human shields, essentially, and that was why they weren't allowed to leave. And so what I was doing was helping them remain calm, but also once Sumy had a humanitarian corridor, helping them get to the border with Poland and Hungary. And so what we saw, a lot of the videos that we saw early on in the war were of African students in particular, but also Indian students, Middle Eastern students who were being turned away, but also some of the students I've been in contact with, it wasn't even getting to the border or getting across the border that was the problem. They weren't being allowed on buses and trains to get to the border. Because they were black or brown, they were being pushed to the back of the line. So it's a multi-step problem that we were seeing with getting African and Indian foreign students out.
Was this an official policy or just something that was made up in the crush of the moment at these train stations?
So this is the problem. Men ages 18 to 60 are not allowed to leave Ukraine because they could be called up for war. But even before this was the situation, I mean, African women and children weren't being allowed on planes, on trains and buses. So it is definitely a matter of racism, but this wasn't the official policy of the Ukrainian government. And it was something that was being enacted on the ground by Ukrainian and Polish officials, from what I understand. But the Ukrainian foreign minister did release a statement about these instances of racism and calling them out and saying they had to stop and there was no reason people of color should not be allowed to cross. And he also set up a hotline for these students and foreigners in general to call if they're having trouble getting across the border. And I think that's due to the incredible amount of international support for these students and also pressure about how they're being treated.
Right. So has this largely been resolved, at least on the Ukrainian side?
From the Ukrainian side, from what I understand, it has been resolved. The biggest problem now isn't getting across the border. It's those African and foreign students who are still in cities in Ukraine that are under Russian siege, like Kherson. That's the big problem now, is getting them out to even get them, you know, to the border with Poland or with Hungary.
And then in that situation, everyone's under siege. It's hard for anyone to get out.
Exactly. And that's been one of the harder things to talk about online and in social media, because people are rightfully angry that you see these videos of African students and are talking about how scared they are and how hungry they are. And it's hard for a lot of people to understand that this isn't just directed towards African students. This is a common problem across the citizenship and the people who live in Kherson, especially, who are stuck because of the Russian occupation.
What about this being used by Russia as propaganda against Ukraine? Do you see that happening?
Absolutely. And this is one of the key things I was worried about before the war began, was if this happened, what could Russia do? And we saw posts from the Russian Foreign Ministry on their English language Twitter. They were reposting videos made by African students who were in Sumy, who were upset about not being allowed to leave. And they used it as propaganda to say, look how racist Ukraine is against these students. Look at how they're treating Black students. And so what we saw was Russia using legitimate examples of racism and anti-Black racism to, you know, support their propaganda against Ukraine and calling Ukraine racist and calling Ukraine a Nazi country. But the problem was, in Sumy, the students were in those conditions because of the Russian occupation.
Wow. Ironic, to put it mildly. What was your experience in Ukraine? Did you, when you were working there and studying there, did you experience racism there?
So my experience in Ukraine was before Euromaidan. So I was there in 2013, and I had a very interesting experience. I did run into a group of skinheads when I was coming, or neo-Nazis when I was coming up off of the subway, and that was terrifying to say the least. But in the same vein, I had a lot of really good experience with the people being really welcoming to me. And of course, there's the problem of being exotic, right? Many people, I was the first Black person many people had ever seen before. So they took pictures of me. At least they asked, you know, they would ask to take pictures of me. I got stared at a lot. But it's a really mixed kind of bag in terms of the experiences you can get. But I was also very careful. I didn't go out at night by myself. I didn't, go to soccer games or soccer stadiums in the middle of the day or when there are soccer games, because those tend to be places and sites of anti-Black racism in Ukraine and in Russia.
Yeah. So when these African students and Asian Indian students as well get out and go to places like Poland, how are they able to get home? Are they able to get home? Are they stuck in these other countries?
This is an excellent point, and I feel like this is being underreported. So many African students, especially those from Nigeria, they have been able to get home. The students I was in contact with from SUMI, who are from Nigeria, are back home now. But you have students from places like Cameroon and the Central African Republic, whose countries don't have the resources to get them home. And so now it's the question of those students who can't get home or those students who want to continue their educations. The EU has opened its doors to Ukrainians who hold Ukrainian passports, but not to third country nationals like these African students. So they have 30 days in Poland or Hungary, and then they have to transit to another country or go home. And they don't have the financial resources to just buy a flight home. So what we're seeing now is the secondary part of the migration crisis of how do you establish a new home? How do you restart, you know, your medical degree you're working on in Ukraine? Because a lot of their lives have been completely upended and they can't go back home. So they're in a kind of limbo right now.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for joining us and talking about this with us and shining a light on it.
Thank you for having me.
Kimberly St. Julian Varnon, she's a PhD fellow at the University of Pennsylvania. Coming up, a rare interview with Saudi Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who is thought to have ordered the murder and dismemberment of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi.
He told me, "Look, Jamal Khashoggi isn't even among the 1,000 people I would kill first if I did things that way."
Graham Wood of The Atlantic is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. 4 years ago, Saudi Arabia's crown prince and de facto ruler, Mohammed bin Salman, known as MBS, received a royal welcome here in the United States, a coast-to-coast tour where he was feted and honored by current and former U.S. presidents and tech leaders like Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates. Even Oprah Winfrey met with MBS as he wrapped up his three-week charm offensive here in L.A. Then, just months later, Mohammed bin Salman became an international pariah. He was accused of orchestrating the gruesome abduction, murder, and dismemberment of prominent Saudi journalist and dissident Jamal Khashoggi. Since then, MBS has kept a fairly low profile, at least by world leader standards, the pandemic providing a convenient excuse to hunker down. But now he has emerged, and he spoke with journalist Graham Wood. Graham has spent years covering Saudi Arabia, ISIS, and the Middle East, and he has a big cover story in the April issue of The Atlantic. It's titled "Absolute Power: The Crown Prince, a Murder, and the Future of Saudi Arabia." Graham Wood joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, why did he agree to meet with you?
Well, I had been traveling around Saudi Arabia on my own, independently of any monitoring by the Saudi state. And after a while, I just said, "Look, I'm writing this story, and it appears that the Crown Prince has been hiding. I'd like to have a conversation with him, and then I'll be able to have his perspective, or I'll just publish my story without it." And eventually, after quite a bit of negotiation, he decided, "Yeah, I'll talk."
What was in it for him, do you think? Or what did he see that was in it for him to speak with you?
He had killed Jamal Khashoggi. His people had killed Jamal Khashoggi. And understandably, journalists were treating him as a pariah, and he needed at some point to show his face again. So I think he had in me a journalist who had at least seen the kingdom, seen the changes that he had been trying to work into the kingdom, which were substantial, and many of them were very real. And so I think he thought this might be the next shot to get his viewpoint out.
Yeah. Well, of course, he has denied orchestrating the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, even though the CIA has come out and said, yes, he did. In fact, it ordered that really disgusting, unspeakable dismemberment, murder of this journalist. In your article, he says, of course, he didn't do it. And he kind of portrays Khashoggi as beneath even consideration of someone to be murdered, that he was so unimportant. Why would he even think to murder him? What did you make of that?
It was a really extraordinary thing that he said about Jamal Khashoggi. He did say he had no responsibility personally, but he said, look, I'm in charge, and it happened under my watch. But just as you say, he told me, look, Jamal Khashoggi isn't even among the 1,000 people I would kill first if I did things that way. He downplayed Khashoggi's role as an overseas voice of dissent against him, which, of course, I knew Jamal Khashoggi personally. I had talked to him about MBS, about the ways in which he dissented from MBS's rule. To me, it seemed very implausible that this person who was well known around the world, you know, MBS told me he had never even read a story by Khashoggi. I personally doubt that, and I found it bizarre that he would really feel self-pity. You know, he told me, look, I've been found guilty in the court of public opinion for the killing of Khashoggi. I'm one of the victims here. So it's a very odd thing to say about someone who was killed and dismembered by one's own staff.
On his orders, by all accounts.
Well, according to the CIA, it's unlikely that people who were working directly for the Crown Prince would have done this without the Crown Prince's approval. So that's the opinion of U.S. intelligence. It's a plausible opinion. They didn't quite find any smoking gun, any email, any direct order that said that his people should do it. But look, the people who actually went into the consulate and killed Jamal were people who were at MBS's side and who had formed part of his security detail. So I think certain inferences can be drawn.
Right. So I want to ask you about some criticism you've received on this, some of it from the Washington Post, where colleagues of Khashoggi described your piece as elevating MBS. They called it, quote, an insult to journalism. They accused you of whitewashing him, of basically giving him a platform to lie about orchestrating Khashoggi's killing. So I assume you've read that criticism. What is your response to that?
Well, first of all, my first response is, we had MBS hiding for 2 years. We didn't know how he was going to respond to these things. I gave him a chance to speak, and he said some things that were so psychologically revealing that even the critics of the piece cannot stop themselves from constantly quoting what he said. I think we actually got quite a bit, and not the things that MBS personally or the Saudi state that he runs wanted to have heard about MBS. The idea that he shouldn't be platformed, I think, is preposterous. After all, he's the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. He rules Saudi Arabia. He has, I think it's fair to say, a platform. So it's really important that we interview people who we despise, people we distrust, and find out how they see the world. And in many cases, I think in this one too, find out how they can, with their own words, convict themselves.
Hmm. So MBS, as I mentioned in the intro, was on this charm offensive before all this happened and trying to convince. And he was pretty convincing to a lot of people that he was going to be a modern, more humane leader and open up Saudi Arabia. From your interactions with him and your extensive reporting through Saudi Arabia, what do you think his motivations are and how does he see the world?
Well, first of all, I would say he is a modernizing figure. Saudi Arabia is almost unique among countries in trying to keep a form of government that had existed before modernity, and it had guarded its place as a pre-modern kingdom. And MBS definitely wants to change that in certain ways. That means more social openness, more economic openness. But the idea that he was going to be more humane, I don't think that was accepted by anyone who was actually watching what he did, even before the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. MBS has been jailing Saudis, striking an atmosphere of fear in the kingdom that really just never existed in, you know, it's an absolute monarchy, but even the absolute monarchs who went before him never did what he was doing. If you dissent publicly from the programs of MBS, there's a really good chance you'll have a knock on your door and you'll be sent to prison. So what I found was, yes, these reforms are happening. No, they do not include anything like political reforms or any of the sort of civil rights that I think in the West that we rightly hold dear.
So what kind of reforms has he put in that Saudis are welcoming?
Well, in the last 10 years, if you went to Saudi Arabia 10 years ago, you would find a state that was heavily restricted, usually for religious reasons, in what you could do socially. You couldn't go to a concert. You couldn't even watch a movie. Certainly couldn't drink alcohol. Of those three things, concerts are happening. They're being sponsored by the Saudi state. There are movie theaters everywhere, even in small cities. And there has been what MBS characterizes as a very successful anti-corruption campaign. And goodness knows, there was a lot of corruption a few years ago. And now I think at least some of that has been curtailed. It's really just alcohol and a few other religious prohibitions that are gone. So for a lot of Saudis who had gotten to know the world and felt like they had to leave their country to experience it, to go to LA, to go to Dubai, to go to London, they no longer have to do that. And they really appreciate MBS for that. But, you know, MBS has sort of struck a deal with them. You will support me through this, and I'll give you these things that you have wanted over the years. But the deal is that you have to support me also when I put your fellow citizens in jail for dissenting from my policies.
There's a very bizarre chapter in your story where you go to this state-run prison in the middle of the desert that's basically a jihadist rehabilitation center. And some notorious prisoners who were in Gitmo are there now. Can you describe this place, why it exists, who goes there, and what happens to them?
I wouldn't have believed it unless I saw it. And even some of the things that I saw, I'm pretty skeptical of, but it was still an amazing thing to see. So the Saudi state in the past has taken people who were on the jihadist spectrum, that is violent because they had in their minds a view of Islam that they thought required them to be violent against the state. And it had tried to talk some sense into them. You know, it would have them talk to government clerics who would try to persuade them that their religion actually forbade them from doing these things. And in the past, when they did that, it just didn't really work. These jihadists were not persuadable. What Saudi seems to have done since is do a complete 180. And instead of trying to persuade them that what they were doing was wrong, it almost tries to bore the jihad right out of them. So it made them work in sort of like a middle management office, and it reminded me of like Dunder Mifflin from the series The Office. So you'd have these big name jihadists from Guantanamo Bay who would be working in cubicles. And it seemed like it kind of worked in the sense that they really preferred that to being in their prison cells. They had things to do. And they said that being busy all day and being bored was just great. And it was much more satisfying than jihadism. So I happen to have known some of the Americans who were colleagues of these jihadists when they were fighting overseas. And it's funny that the Americans did not do so great when they were brought to the United States and put in Terre Haute Federal Penitentiary. They came out and they were just as radical as before. So the Saudis, they just figured they'd try something different. And in this case, maybe they succeeded, maybe they didn't, but they certainly are thinking outside the box.
Well, what's going to happen to these prisoners? Will they be released?
Yeah, so once they finish their sentence, then they're supposed to be let out with maybe a little bit more reorientation to the free world. And then we'll see how it goes. You know, in the past, jihadists have been let out, and then they reoffend. They rejoin groups. It seems in the past almost as if the only thing you can do is just distract them and incapacitate them until they get too old to fight. But these guys are going to try to get out. They'll try to apply the management lessons that they learned from their Dunder Mifflin experience in the Saudi prison and, you know, ideally not reoffend. But we'll see if it actually works.
So does MBS portray himself and the royal family as the only thing standing between the world and these jihadis, that were it not for the royal family, Saudi Arabia would just be a terrorist hot zone, feeding ground, if you will, that it would just be uncontrollable without them?
Yeah, that's exactly what he says. You know, he really takes in a lot of American pop culture, watches Netflix, that kind of thing. And he's seen the movie Mad Max, Fury Road. And he said to me, look, Saudi Arabia could modernize, but if it doesn't work, the downside risk is serious. My program has to work because there's a lot of jihadists out there. There's a lot of people who want to disrupt the kingdom, make it fail. And failure means anarchy. So the Saudis know it's a choice between my vision, which he calls Vision 2030, or Mad Max. And, you know, in that way, he's a lot like other Arab autocrats from more secular states who've basically said, look, it's either me or true disaster. So if you don't like me, then consider how bad it could be if I don't succeed. Of course, what he doesn't say is one of the reasons it will be so bad if I don't succeed is because he's rigged the situations in such a way that he's guaranteeing that it will be that way. He's trying to make a tough deal for everyone, that is the United States, certainly for Saudis, saying that you have to support me because the alternatives, I will guarantee, are all terrible. They're Mad Max, they're Afghanistan, they're things that you don't want.
How has President Biden approached MBS and Saudi Arabia? He has not, I believe, met with MBS because he doesn't see him as an equal. He's not the official leader of Saudi Arabia, after all. But how does he view him personally?
MBS is really aggrieved by the way that he's been treated by the Biden administration. Kamala Harris, Biden himself, they've sort of suggested that they hope that MBS is not the person who succeeds his father, who's elderly and still technically the king of Saudi Arabia, but he's officially signed over most of his powers to MBS. So MBS, he feels like he's being treated like something other than what he is, which is the ruler of the country. And he's not happy about that. I asked him whether there was anything about Biden that, you know, maybe Biden just doesn't quite get you. And he's like, no, I don't care what Biden thinks. Biden, do what you're going to do, and let's see where it leads you. It was sort of the Saudi version of make my day. If you're not going to deal with us, then we'll look elsewhere. We will look to China. We will look to Russia. We would like to be friends with you. But until we're treated as a full ally, then we'll consider options elsewhere, too.
But how is the war now in Ukraine changing Biden's calculation when it comes to Saudi Arabia? Because they need Saudi Arabia and Saudi Arabian oil, at least Europe does, now that a lot of the Russian oil has been the subject of sanctions.
Yeah, Saudi Arabia, of course, has this magical power, which pretty much no other country has, which is at will it can produce more oil or less oil, and therefore really manage the energy markets of the world. And so if you want to put pressure on Putin, you can sanction him. But what is really going to hurt him is if oil is not that expensive. Cheaper oil means less power for Putin, and cheaper oil is something that MBS can deliver just by will alone. So when the United States has gone to MBS in the last week or so and pretty much just asked, we would like to have more oil pumped, cheaper oil, MBS has responded somewhat petulantly and said, look, you haven't treated me with respect before. When you call me up, all you want is a favor and then to moralize to me. And maybe you should have thought of that before, when you know, before you were asking. If we had a nicer relationship, then maybe I would answer more responsibly. Of course, the United States is historically been so close to Saudi Arabia, MBS certainly would like to continue that relationship. But in the meantime, he's sort of dragging his feet on being maximally helpful because he doesn't think he's got any respect.
Is there a way that Biden might actually give him some respect or the respect that he desires? Do you think that that could happen?
Maybe. I mean, the thing about MBS, of course, is that he's an autocrat at heart. He has no intention of liberalizing. And so in some ways, there will never be, you know, meeting of the minds between Americans, Democrats, and the Saudis. And as long as American foreign policy has this moralistic component, which, by the way, I support, then MBS is going to be never fully happy and will be looking elsewhere, like China or like Russia, which does not have that component. I think, though, that at some point the Biden administration or whatever comes next is going to have to realize MBS, the idea that he's not going to be king and that you don't have to deal with him eventually, is looking more and more like a fantasy. His grip on power is stronger than it was before the death of Jamal Khashoggi. It's stronger than it ever has been. And most likely, he's still a young man. He's going to be elevated to the throne and he'll be in power for decades. So it's going to be a very complex diplomatic dance to reestablish that kind of friendship and to make sure that it happens on terms that are morally satisfying for the United States.
Well, the United States has never had a clear moral relationship with Saudi Arabia.
No, I mean, Saudi Arabia has always been an absolute monarchy, which is antithetical to our most deeply held political values. There has, of course, always been a functional relationship that includes sale of oil in one direction, sale of weapons in another direction. And the United States and Saudi Arabia have, in a way, made it work. But in another way, that relationship has just led to catastrophe. You know, 9/11, the great majority of the hijackers being Saudi. And eventually to the point where Saudi Arabia was in crisis and MBS is presenting himself as the solution to that. So, you know, it's been a poisoned relationship from the beginning. And, you know, MBS in some ways is solving problems that have existed in that relationship, but is also just promising that certain problems will persist. And that's the failure to see eye to eye on those moral and deep political value questions.
Well, Graham, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Graham Wood, his profile of Mohammed bin Salman is the cover story in the current issue of The Atlantic. Coming up, Questlove on his Oscar-nominated documentary Summer of Soul, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Mr. Backlash, who do you think I am? The documentary Summer of Soul takes us back to the 1969 Harlem Cultural Festival, sometimes known as the Black Woodstock. It was a massive summer-long concert series featuring some of the biggest names in music, such as Nina Simone, B.B. King, Mavis Staples. The entire festival was filmed, but the footage sat mostly unseen for more than 50 years. That is, until the musician Amir Questlove Thompson discovered the archive and turned it into a documentary. It's now nominated for Best Documentary Feature at this year's Oscars. All this week, we'll be hearing from the filmmakers in that category. Questlove spoke with KCRW's Novena Carmel back in August. She is, of course, the co-host of Morning Becomes Eclectic, and here is a bit of their conversation.
You know, it makes so much sense that you, the ultimate collector and music historian, came across this lost footage. Can you share with us how the footage ended up in your lap and how you knew you needed to make this film?
All right. Well, my first introduction to the Harlem Cultural Festival actually starts in 1997 when the roots are first in Tokyo, Japan. My translator, admiring my afro, says, and I quote, "I think you love Don Cornelius. Like, you look like Don Cornelius, and I want to take you somewhere." So she takes me to the Soul Train Cafe, which is really like Fridays with a bunch of monitors playing, you know, clips of the day, soul clips. And I happen to see 2 to 3 minutes of the Sly and the Family Stone performance, which was done from a camera that was like one of the bird's eye view far away cameras. So because I couldn't see what the audience looked like, I just naturally assumed that what I was watching was like the Montreux Jazz Festival, like some European festival. Of course, 20 years later, these two gentlemen approached me with an idea of this footage that they just acquired, and they want me to direct this movie.
Wow.
And I was highly skeptical because I Googled what they were talking about and nothing was there. I called, you know, the Nelson Georges of the world, like all the New York luminaries, that from everyone I knew that was like a journalist, Michael Gonzalez, Nelson George, everybody that had a proximity of New York, and none of them heard of the Harlem Culture Festival. And so I wasn't convinced that they were being truthful. Like, I was just like, well, you can't Google it. And
wow,
none of my New York friends know about this. So did it really happen? And then they dropped 40 hours of footage in my lap. And then I'm like, oh yeah, this really did happen. So it was literally trial by fire.
So you saw the footage, and was that when you knew that you needed to make it into a film? How did you know you need to make it into a film?
One, I needed to be convinced that I was the person to make it into the film.
Yeah.
Because in my mind, I'm like, well, I'm a first-time driver. Like, you're giving me this 18-wheeler to hoist across America for the first time. I just got my permit. But, you know, the thing is that the more I kept looking at the footage, the more I realized that this is history I'm looking at, and this is really my chance to make it right and correct history. So It took me 3 months, but once, I'll say by late 2017, like around October, November, then it was like, okay, kids, we're going to make a movie.
Yeah.
Let's start. So first thing I had to do was sit with 40 hours of footage and look at nothing else but 40 hours of footage.
Okay, so while you're going through this footage, how do you decide what is going to go in the movie?
You know, it's weird. My producer, Joseph Patel, said something wise. I was just like, I don't know where to start. Like, how do you even start this thing? He's like, well, look, treat it like a DJ gig. Like, how would you craft or curate a DJ gig? And I have a very specific method when I put shows together for people or curate shows or even do DJ gigs or playlist. The first thing I work on is what's my ending. I want to know what my last 15 minutes look like. Wow. Because I want the audience walking away with a feeling. And so I think about what's my ending. And then in my experiences growing up, going to concerts and whatnot, you know, you have uncles describing their first Earth, Wind & Fire concerts. You know, my sister's describing like what the Jacksons did when they first came out on stage and levitated, da 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 da. And so that's what I was searching for. And the very first thing that I saw was Stevie Wonder's drum solo. And I instantly knew this is something I never saw before. So I know the world hasn't seen this. My ending, however, I will say that in my first draft, I made the climax of the film, which is Mavis Staples and Mahalia Jackson. That was my initial ending.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And it hit way different as an ending than it did in the middle, because with Nina Simone in the middle and Mahalia and Mavis at the end, it kind of gave it a kind of a kumbaya and a good time was had by all Hollywood ending. It would have been nice. And I didn't want to be nice. I wanted to really reflect and hammer home the point that we were living in the same exact conditions that were happening 50 years ago. And so when you reverse the two and put Nina Simone at the end, there's more of a sense of urgency. And when you put Mahalia and Mavis in the middle, then there's the pressure to really elevate the film so that it matches what you just saw and that we don't wait.
It's just so crazy that this whole festival was taped and sort of forgotten. And I'm curious if you think that, I mean, when we think about it was forgotten, it's like, okay, well, that was, you know, 69. There wasn't social media. It's sort of understandable, right? It was filmed and then put away. But now in 2021, do you think that we're at risk of losing or hiding documentation of an important moment in culture? Is that still possible today?
You know what? The irony isn't lost on me that this film and the talk of Black erasure is coming out at the same time in which, at the beginning of this conversation, as far as social media was concerned, the old guy in me was sort of like rolling his eyes because, you know, the updated version of that conversation is about like content on TikTok with Black creators that we're having right now. And, you know, in the beginning, the old guy in me was just sort of like rolling his eyes like, dog, man, it's just a 15-second dance thing. Like, it's a dumb dance. Like, it's not going to matter. So the thing is that, I know the narrative is framed like, you know, the concert that wasn't allowed to come out. Like, you know, the sort of thing like, over my dead body, I will not let this die. It was less that.
Yeah.
And more just kind of a more dangerous, benign dismissiveness that I think is actually way more dangerous than the narrative of like the evil Derek Dastardly, like taking all 40 hours of the reels and put them on the train tracks. You know, like now you'll never have your history, Black people. Like it's sort of a benign racism that we don't have a conversation about that's also just as damaging to our history. And I just simply believe that, you know, movie heads were sort of like, well, yeah, this is all well and good, but this probably won't make money. And it's not that big of a deal to me. And as a result, the story has taken a long time, 50 years to actually come out.
Yeah. And somehow eventually right on time. And we're so thankful that it made it into the right hands, the right team, and for everybody to see. And for the way that you put it into context is really amazing. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Before you go, we have to ask, because it is a music show, if you will leave us with a couple of song suggestions that encapsulate the energy of the summer of 1969. Take us back to the feeling, Amir.
Okay. There's a performance that I feel really captures it perfectly. There's a live version of Stevie Wonder's I Was Made to Love Her that's from his 1970 Talk of the Town album. But to me, that is one of the most dangerous versions of that song he's ever done. Like he goes to another place in that song with just his gospel ad-libbing and whatnot. So, yeah, I'll say that Stevie Wonder's I Was Made to Love Her is probably that particular live version from the Talk of the Town album.
Amazing. Amir, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
You can catch Summer of Soul on Hulu or at select theaters right now.
That's KCRW's Novena Carmel, co-host of Morning Becomes Eclectic, speaking with Questlove about his documentary Summer of Soul. nominated for Best Documentary Feature at this year's Academy Awards. You can hear more of their conversation at KCRW.com. Well, don't forget, you can follow Press Play on Twitter and Instagram at KCRW Press Play. Tweet us, tell us what you like, what you want to hear more of. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you tomorrow.